Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. Whether it's helping a single mom in Dundalk keep her home or giving a bright student in Sandtown a chance to be his best, United Way fights for families. Help them win the fight. Visit uwcm.org/fight.
This is Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun with episode 432 of the Roughly Speaking podcast. There is a lot of noise in America today, a lot of rancor and racism and tribalism. When he ran for office, Donald Trump, speaking to white crowds at rallies, said the nation's first black president had divided the country.
Our president has divided this country so bad. Yeah.
And even if that was true, in the 2 years since his election, Trump can hardly be said to be a healing, unifying force. In fact, as the midterms approach, Trump is exploiting the nation's hyper-partisanship with more of his divisive, fear-mongering rhetoric, framing the midterm elections not as a referendum on his first 2 years in office, but as a battle over immigration and race. It's a nasty time in America. And along comes sociologist Eric Klinenberg with a suggestion for restoring civil society before our democracy collapses. Build new libraries. Expand and improve the old ones. Build more playgrounds and tot lots. Build more public spaces where people can see each other face to face, get to know their neighbors, even encounter the not so like-minded. Eric Klinenberg has been pitching the need for the U.S. to invest in what he calls social infrastructure, the physical spaces that influence how people interact. We need more of them, he says, especially at a time when political polarization and technology, starting with the smartphone, segregates and isolates us. As America rebuilds for the future, socially minded design, influenced ground up and not top down, will be essential if we are to return to some semblance of civil order. Eric Klinenberg, based at New York University, spent a lot of time studying public libraries and what they do in the internet age. It turns out they do a lot, and predictions for their demise were wrong. We see that in Baltimore with the great Enoch Pratt Free Library System, recently featured on national television and named one of Reader's Digest's 10 nicest places in America. Eric Klinenberg has written a book, Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. And he was in Baltimore this week to speak at Johns Hopkins in a talk sponsored by the Agora Institute. That's where I caught up with him after a walk across the Homewood campus on a superb October afternoon. So I walked from Charles Street to Mason Hall with my GPS. It told me where to make lefts and right-hand turns. I didn't have to stop and ask anyone for directions, which, as you know, can lead to pleasant conversation, eye contact with students or faculty on the campus. Didn't have to do it. So there's technology that's helping me find you, and yet I must have walked past 100 people on the way here and didn't even make eye contact. So I guess I bring it up because I was thinking about your scholarship on this and the way technology can actually help us interact with each other instead of isolating us.
Yeah. So sometimes technology does help us connect, and I really do think that there are young people who are socializing in interesting ways that people my age have yet to quite figure out. But that said, the efficiency that you're describing, I think, has become the enemy of good social life. You know, we rely on devices rather than each other, and that's not just true when we're driving in a car or walking in our cities. You know, it's also true when it comes to all kinds of social life, and too much efficiency in this regard actually pulls us away from one another. You know, I think about all the relationships that develop in a waiting area outside of a school or in a childcare center or on a playground because you're just stuck in this place and your kid's not ready to go yet, and there's other people who are in your situation around you. And if you can stop and talk to them, who knows what's going to happen? I mean, millions of relationships have formed because two mothers are pushing the same swing set or waiting for their same kid to get out of school. But I've also now spent time, and I've got young kids. You know, I'm in those situations now, and I see everyone go for the phone the moment there's a downbeat. And if we do that, there's just no chance of getting to know each other.
This is so true. What you just said is so true. And I do the same thing all the time now. It seems like too much. One other thing I want to share with you, a personal experience just before I came here, was an argument that developed on Facebook about Trump. Of course, you know, he's the source of lots of arguments. This one was really vexing because the man who was communicating with me, posting on my Facebook page, was trying to say that there's an equivalence between Trump's play to racism and fear, his fear-mongering, and what the Democrats do. So I was thinking, if I was in a bar, my favorite bar is the Swallow at the Hollow in Baltimore. If that had happened in a bar, that might have erupted into quite a loud argument, and with beer and alcohol, you know, even more so maybe. But I think I would have preferred that than just this cold sort of, you know, safe back and forth on Facebook.
I think we go from 0 to 60 with the hate on Twitter and Facebook. I mean, Twitter's worse than Facebook in a way. I posted something this week about Trump's policy on the trans issue, and I called it an act of violence, you know, to essentially try to negate the humanity and the reality of a whole group of people. And Breitbart posted my tweet, and within minutes, my Twitter feed filled up with such extraordinary venom. You know, people I'd never spoken to. And I have to believe that if that the people who were sending me those messages had been next to me face to face, we probably would have argued, but I think that we could have done it in a civil way. You know, I have a funny situation. I spend my weekends now and some number of days during the week also on these soccer fields because my son is 12 and he plays on a regional team up in New York. And that means on our team, we have a couple parents from Manhattan like me, but there's a big group of folks from Long Island and a bunch of them wear Make America Great hats, Make America Great Again hats, and are Trump voters. And there's also a bunch of Hispanic immigrants, you know, people from countries that the Trump lovers would like to block out. And if we met each other on Twitter, it would be a storm of hatred. But instead, we met each other because we love our sons, and to some extent, we love soccer, though maybe a little bit less each week because there are a lot of games. But we've gotten to know each other over months, and so we start with the things that we have in common. And that could also be just that we like this bar in Baltimore. And it's easier to find some common humanity in that. And I guess the reason I've been writing so much about this issue is I think that we've grown so divided and polarized that we need to find some elementary common ground. We need to find the foundations and figure out if we can build something like a collective project again. And if we can't, I think we're in real trouble.
Your book, your scholarship, reminds me of a book that had a lot of influence on me several years ago by Ray Oldenburg, a book called The Great Good Place, in which he mourned. It was kind of a pain to informal gathering places, bar rooms, coffee shops, things that were common and commonly used in small towns and cities years ago and are less so, that, you know, I guess since the days of television, which keeps people home in the evening, air conditioning, which keeps people indoors in the summer. So we have less human contact, less sort of informal gatherings like that. A soccer team is something that's organized and puts you there in a regional soccer team, right? It's not just a place that where you go and you meet people informally of diverse background, right?
That's true. But, you know, and I like that book very much. I write about in my book what I call social infrastructure, which is an unusual phrase, but I think it has some power because it speaks to the fact that just as there's an infrastructure that, you know, gets us electricity and transit and communications, so too is this kind of material substratum that supports social life. And you know, some social infrastructure can be the third places that Oldenburg wrote about, you know, the bars and the cafes. But there's also a set of public projects. You know, I write a lot in the book about libraries, you know, neighborhood branch libraries, not the big grand ones, you know, with the fancy pillars and everything, but the little places where people of different varieties come together, and playgrounds, you know, and parks. We're talking on a college campus, you know, some are more open and accessible than others, but schools are essential social infrastructures. And, you know, I really believe that when we invest in these places, we become all the more likely to interact with each other. And they can be, you know, planned interactions with friends or neighbors, because there's a pleasant place to go together. But they can also be these serendipitous encounters. And if you've got, let's take a playground, you know, you've got a place like a playground, and it's in your neighborhood, and it's a safe place, and it's taken care of, you're going to go there recurrently. And if you go there enough times, you're going to bump into the same set of people. And at some point, you're going to be there, and you're going to recognize another mother or father from a bunch of visits, and you're going to get a call. You have to do something. And it's amazing how quickly parents come to trust each other, because they have this solidarity, regardless of their politics or their race or class. And I have seen some incredible relationships form in places that are diverse like this. The challenge, I think, of our time is that we have neglected places like this, and we have segregated ourselves, you know, so that you don't encounter people from different groups often enough. And in some ways, I mean, kind of race maps onto class, and, you know, in this city and in a lot of them, but the class divisions are as profound as the race ones as well, you know. And so we failed to invest in those shared places, I think, at our peril. And the reason I instead of third places, I talk about social infrastructure is that it strikes me that we've reached this moment where, you know, we all believe that society is broken to some extent, and we know that we have to invest massively in infrastructure as well. And so I guess what I'm saying is, instead of just building a wall, you know, which is one popular idea of the moment, you know, we can think about social infrastructure as a way of investing in ourselves and, you know, repairing ourselves as well.
So it sounds like this is a call out to community planners, to people in government, people in private sector who are thinking about how communities should look and how they should be developed, and also to the rest of us, but how we interact and seek out others.
So first, there's an argument that there's a force that's shaping our capacity to connect with each other and achieve some kind of solidarity and common purpose that we haven't recognized. We don't have a concept for social infrastructure yet. I mean, hopefully we do now. But I want this argument to be available to everyone when we go and talk about what we need to do to make our cities better, our neighborhoods better, our towns better, right? Because I think we haven't seen just how powerful a force something like a neighborhood library can be, or a really good playground or park. We don't quite have the vocabulary for making an argument about why it's in the public interest to invest in a library, you know, not as a luxury, but as an essential part of our infrastructure. So there's that first. But then also, yes, I mean, I have been talking to political officials. You know, someone went out and bought a copy of my book for every member of the New York City Council. I'm going to meet with the people from the Obama Foundation. And there's a Republican senator, Ben Sasse, who's got a set of ideas that are very similar to these, actually, about building shared places. David Brooks, the conservative columnist in the New York Times, just wrote an article about the book saying the same thing. Repairing our social infrastructure is something that we can't do as individuals. We can do it as citizens by calling for some support, but we really are going to rely on some collective investments. And I'd like to see philanthropy play a role. I think private sector, you know, people can help to develop it too. But ultimately, at the end of the day, this is something we're going to have to do as a public.
So do you see it as a way to develop socially healthier people, or to break through the polarization that we have? Because you talked about the way we've segregated ourselves. With the big sort has already happened, you know, people live in red counties and blue counties, and we've kind of sorted ourselves out that way among the like-minded. We live among the like-minded, tend to anyway. So you wouldn't be challenged with a conservative view if you lived in a mainly liberal neighborhood someplace where there is a tot lot. The people you meet may be like-minded, right?
So there's different issues. I mean, the way the book is organized is that I explain, you know, drawing on my own research, I'm a social scientist, and a lot of other social science research, how investing in gathering places, shared spaces, can help us deal with a whole bunch of problems that we care about. And so The chapters are about loneliness and social isolation. There's a chapter about health. There's a chapter about crime, a chapter about education. So these are all kind of core issues that kind of matter regardless of how polarized and divided we are. And the thesis is by building these places, we're going to be able to solve problems in ways that we haven't been able to see. And there's a lot of evidence for that. But you're right that another big argument in the book is about this chapter that's on polarization. And I'm not so naive to think that if we just build a bunch of libraries and parks, you know, we're going to solve our problems of polarization. You know, I'm as bogged down by the pain of this problem as anyone else, and I see just how difficult it is. That said, I want to say two things. You know, first of all, I don't see any way forward on this polarization problem besides trying to build places where people can come together. I mean, we're not gonna heal our divisions on Twitter, I'll tell you that. And if we're going to make any progress, I think it's only gonna be because we find some way to establish a real human, you know, connection to other people who disagree with us. You know, just as, by the way, if you're looking at the situation in Israel and Palestine, the groups that are trying to heal the divisions are bringing people together. And unfortunately, that's just about where we are in the United States right now, where we need to kind of rehumanize each other because unprecedented numbers of Democrats think that Republicans are actually dangerous for the nation, and unprecedented number of Republicans think that Democrats are dangerous for the nation. So we really are divided. Back to your immediate point, I have done field work in communities throughout the United States and found that even in very exclusive zones, the places where people come together and have these encounters with people who are different from them are places like branch libraries. You know, even if we're very rarely 100% segregated by ideology or by ethnicity. Some neighborhoods, unfortunately, are 100% segregated by race. I grew up in Chicago, and there's places like that, and Baltimore's got some similarities to Chicago in that respect. But there are some places where people come together, and I'll bet you, as segregated as Baltimore is, that if you go into branch libraries in Baltimore, you will find a pretty interesting cross-section of people, right? And oftentimes the segregation is like, here's four blocks together that are all white, and here's four blocks together that are all black, and here's four that are all, you know, Mexican-American. At least that's how Chicago works. And the library sits right between them, and people are forced to deal with each other's humanity in the library, or on public transit, or in a playground. And so it's only in these places that I think we have some chance of rebuilding.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes the writing collective Unruly Catholic Women Writers for a reading and discussion of their new anthology, Unruly Catholic Nuns, Sister Stories. Sister Stories explores the voices of current and former Catholic nuns, and by doing so, contributes to the global conversation about the role of women in the Catholic Church today. Sunday, October 28th at 5 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
What about the sports arena? Someone said the other day, the good of it is that it is a place where we come together to root for, you know, for the home team.
I totally agree with that. I mean, so, you know, Baltimore is divided against Washington, D.C., you know, that way
with the Ravens, the football Ravens, it's Pittsburgh, the main rivalry.
Right. So we become local nationalists. You know, I'm not mixing my AFC and NFC teams here. But but they do bind us together, right, as local fan communities. And not only that, but it gives us something to talk about, right? So I grew up in Chicago as a sports city, man. I mean, we're talking about sports all the time. And if you are a sports fan and you grew up in Chicago, you can talk to anybody on any day, because there's always, you know, how badly the Cubs just played and the fact that Michael Jordan is the greatest basketball player that ever existed, and if only the Bears could get Dicka back. You know, I mean, there's just always a conversation that you can have that's there for you. And I'll tell you something, you know, I remember I was in college when the cable television station started to come in and develop these exclusive deals with the sports franchises, especially baseball teams. And before that, you could watch all the baseball games for free. And suddenly, if you wanted to watch the baseball games, you needed to have enough money to pay for cable. And back then, cable was like a new thing and it was expensive, like not everybody had cable. And I remember feeling like this was dangerous because suddenly access to local sports was going to become a class issue, you know? And I think now we just take for granted that you kind of have to have cable TV as a cost of being an American in some areas. But that's clearly not true for everybody. And it remains the case that we don't all have equal access to that conversation in the way that we used to. So, I think that, look, sports can be divisive, and there's, you know, you can look to other countries to see the hooliganism and the violence that sometimes happens in sports matches. But that said, the playing field is a common ground where people can come together. At the amateur level, it can be especially nice, but the professional teams play a role in our societies as well.
I just throw in one more Baltimore venue here that comes to mind is the public markets, and Lexington Market being the oldest one, the largest one. One of the best feelings I've ever had about being in Baltimore was being at a blues jam session in the midst of Lexington Market, where people are eating sandwiches or drinking a beer and listening to this music. And that's where I saw the most racial diversity and the most happiness. Everybody sort of excited by the music they were listening to.
I'm totally with you on that. Not long ago, I went to visit my family in Chicago. I live in New York City now, and I went to Millennium Park, and there was a dance festival, and it's just all of Chicago was there, and it was glorious, and people were dancing together, people were hanging out together. It's in those moments like that that you feel the best about the city that you live in. But you know what? Those moments don't come out of nowhere, and they're not costless, right? You have to make an investment in a park or in a market. You know, you have to close down the streets. You have to subsidize putting those things together. And I think that until very recently, cities sponsored those kinds of things as an afterthought and as a luxury, you know, only if it's good. And it's only been recently that we've started to appreciate the value of promoting those things as part of our urban policy, as, you know, as part of our local policy. And where we haven't quite connected the dots, I think, is at the national level by thinking about, you know, what kind of society we want to build. And, you know, an interesting thing about infrastructure, again, is that it tends to be a kind of technocratic area where, like, the people who sponsor infrastructure projects tell us, like, you regular citizens don't know what you're talking about. Like, trust us, you know, we'll bring in the big engineers and they'll tell you, you know, what to build and how it's going to be built and how much money it's going to cost. I mean, there's nothing democratic about the process of building infrastructure. I would like to see a more robust democratic conversation in places like Baltimore, but also in Washington, D.C., about the kind of society that we want to build. Because you know what? What we build is an expression of who we are and what we value. And we build in a big highway system, you know, we're expressing a value about the kind of world we want to make. And inevitably, in coming years, we are going to be spending billions and then tens and then hundreds of billions of dollars on new systems and structures because we have to. Things are falling apart, you know, and it might not happen under this president. That infrastructure week might never come around, and that's probably a good thing. But at some point, we're going to have to make a massive investment in infrastructure. And if we have a concept like social infrastructure, we have a whole set of options that we don't otherwise have. But we also have a capacity to access it as citizens in a more democratic fashion. And that's exactly what we need to be doing.
I had one question about kids. Are we, meaning parents, American parents, have we or are we preventing our kids from the healthy social life? I mean, on one hand, we say you're spending too much time on your phone or your computer, too much time with video games. On the other hand, we're helicopters, right? We're all over them all the time. We don't want them to stray very far. We want them to be safe. We worry about their safety. Kids are sort of caught in the middle there, aren't they? Are they? On one hand, you want them to not be tied to their phone or the computer all the time. On the other hand, you don't want them straying very far, going off in the woods to play with other kids.
So I was a kid in Chicago in the 1970s and 80s, which was objectively so much more violent and dangerous than Baltimore is today, you know, or any of the cities we have are today. There's a lot of bad stuff going on. When I was a kid, I grew up very close to some very dangerous housing projects. As a feature of being a kid in Chicago, I had to learn like which side of the block you walk on, which gang signs to avoid, you know, which neighborhoods to avoid at different times of day. But I will tell you something. From the time I was 9 years old, between the hours of about 3 and whenever it got dark out, nobody in the world had any idea where I was. I mean, literally, no, I mean, there maybe there's a couple miles where I could have been, but my parents didn't have any idea where I was. There were no mobile phones. Just, I was with my friends. We were walking around the streets. We were going to each other's apartments. I had to be home by dinner. And if I wasn't home by dark, then they'd start calling around. But I knew to be home by dark. If I treated my kids that way today, I would be arrested. You know, there was a kid, there was a mother who was arrested a few weeks ago in a suburb of Chicago because she let her 9-year-old walk the dog by herself, you know, early in the morning. We've lost our minds when it comes to this thing. And I think you're making an amazing point. We basically tell our kids that they can't play on their own. You know, there's no free-range children anymore. And we police them. We schedule everything. There's no big breaks in school. You know, they're monitored all the time. And the one place that they can be free and on their own and communicating without us overseeing them is on their phones. So, of course, they want to socialize on their phones all the time. And then as soon as they go on the phones, we get angry because they're there. So we're really putting them in a bind. And I think we're exhausting ourselves. This can't be a good thing. So, you know, my 12-year-old now goes to school in downtown Manhattan. And 3 days a week, he goes to a little neighborhood in Queens, you know, with a friend or two, by themselves. You know, they jump on the subway, and then they either get on a bus in Queens or they walk a mile in Queens, in not the fanciest neighborhood in Queens. You know, it's the real place. And, you know, I think it's great for them. Kind of can only hope that it stays great, you know. And if anything ever goes wrong, every parent in the world is going to say, see that, you know, that's exactly why you need to, you know, monitor your child everywhere you go. But I think we need to give our kids a chance to become independent and free-thinking people and to figure out the world. And yeah, there's some ages that are too early, but by the time, you know, you're a middle school kid, you should be able to do some of that.
Eric, just one last question about libraries. I'm glad to hear you mention libraries, but you're supposed to be quiet in libraries. You're not supposed to talk in libraries. You're not supposed to socialize. However, we know libraries have programs. People come, they listen to lectures, they watch movies. They get on computers, right? They have book clubs, readings. That's what you mean, right?
I do. And look, I spent about a year going to libraries every day, branch libraries, and that's really the meat of this book. In fact, the title, Palaces for the People, comes from Andrew Carnegie. That was his phrase to describe libraries, you know, these exalted places where people who were living in tenements and working in factories could go and, you know, become the best version of themselves, you know, study, try to aspire to something. Libraries were there to help with that. And I wanted to see what the modern library looks like and how it operates as social infrastructure. And the thing is that there are places in libraries today where you're supposed to be quiet, just like in the old days. You know, they're now reading areas, and people respect that. But there are a lot of other places in libraries where it's okay to socialize. In fact, you know, libraries are now the places where people go to get free access to Wi-Fi, or to get a machine, right? Because not everybody can afford a data plan or to have Wi-Fi at home. A lot of people don't have computers or iPads or whatever, so they use it at the library. And there's, you know, very loud early literacy programs for young people. And there's, you know, cantankerous people who go to the library for companionship. And I mean, in a way, we ask too much of our libraries now because, you know, if you're homeless and you get kicked out of the shelter in the morning, you go to the library. If you've got a mental illness, your therapist will tell you to go to the library to get a warm place. And if you have an opioid addiction, you know, after you get, you know, your methadone, they'll send you to the library because you're not going to get in trouble there. And so it's an impossible situation, to be honest. But what it means is that libraries have this new life. And, you know, some of us think of libraries as obsolete. But I can tell you that there's very few places that you could find in this city or any other that are more alive and interesting than the local library. And there are also places where you have to learn how to engage in civil society because you will be pressed up against someone who's different from you, who has every right to that place that you have.
Yeah, so true of the Enoch Pratt system in Baltimore. When the internet came along some years after that, people thought, well, that's the end of libraries because people are going to read their books on their tablets and they're not going to need libraries. Just the opposite happened here with the Enoch Pratt system. So since the book came out, it's only been a month or so, but I wonder, was there a letter you received or a comment at a reading or something that really made you feel like, hey, you know, I've really struck a chord here with people?
Well, the coolest thing so far is that there's this thing called the Postcard Underground, which I had never heard of. And, you know, I wrote this op-ed in the New York Times the week the book came out, which is like to restore civil society, try the library, and it was this kind of account of all the incredible things that libraries do. And somehow this landed in the postcard underground world. And I came home and it was like Harry Potter getting invited to go to Hogwarts. I got this deluge of postcards that kept coming to my office, you know, telling me, hey, we really appreciate the fact that you understand what's happening in libraries. And I guess it's been
Is that an organized thing?
I haven't been able to figure it out, but it must be, because the postcards are coming from all over the place. So if you're listening and you know what the postcard underground is, you know, maybe write in or something so we can figure this out. But it's been awesome. And the other thing is,
all the postcards are, yeah, right on, we agree with you about libraries.
Yeah, it's the opposite of the Twitter experience. It's they're nice and supportive, and they make you smile. Libraries are having a certain moment, and I've gotten a lot of interest from people who run libraries, you know, from librarians who I think are happy to be recognized and appreciated and understood. You know, maybe there's a moment now where we'll start to you know, take seriously what it means to invest in these places and not to take them for granted. Because you know what? Imagine we didn't have a library. Imagine that the library had not been invented and you went to City Hall or to Congress and said, you know, I've got this great idea. Let's open up buildings all over the city, really nice buildings, and let's staff them with people who are just there to help you and not to judge you or surveil you or report on you. And we'll keep the doors open as much as possible. And we'll welcome in everyone, regardless of their age or race or social class, even their citizenship status. And then when they come in the doors, what we'll say to them is, you can have access to all of our shared cultural heritage for free because you're a human being. You know, if you propose that right now in Congress, they'd put you in a straitjacket. And send you away somewhere. And the fact is that
they call it socialism of some kind.
And the fact is that we have that. That is, we have inherited that. And we've inherited that because we once had a vision of what it means to live in a good society and to invest in each other regardless of who we are. And if we don't respect that and own up to the responsibilities that come from that, we will live in an impoverished world, and we will never get over these divisions that are tearing us apart. But if we appreciate that heritage and realize that it's our job now to update them and invest in them and make them work for the next generation of people so that they have a chance to benefit the way all of us did and our parents and our grandparents and their grandparents did, you know, if we don't do that for the next generation, then I don't know what our future is.
Eric, thank you.
It's been great. Thank you so much.
Sociologist Eric Kleinenberg is the author of Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Eric Kleinenberg is professor of sociology and director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. I spoke with him at Johns Hopkins at the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Agora Institute. Coming up on new episodes of Roughly Speaking, Baltimore Sun reporter Kevin Rector talks about his deep look at the proposal to replicate Japan's 311-mile-per-hour magnetic levitation train, the Maglev, along the Northeast Corridor of the United States. And on Friday, it's our pre-Halloween special with critics Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed, a talk about Frankenstein in film over the years. I'm Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun for producers Steve Early and Hallie Miller. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. From housing and education to healthcare and employment, they will help you fight to make the biggest difference in your community. Join the fight at uwcm.org/fight.